but some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about at the beginning has some numbers, and it's just easier, I think, to see numbers rather than hear them as I speak. So I'm going to be talking about the research that I did in the Made in Canada report, which you can download off the Metcalf Foundation website. And I want to connect it up. It does really follow from what Adrian was saying around thinking about how to build resistance and what about the workers. And for me, one of the important things about building resistance is understanding what are the ties, what are the chains that bind us, and where are the weak points, how do they fit together, how can we dismantle a system that has been created specifically in order to produce the kind of vulnerabilities that we see with workers. And I suppose where I'd like to start is recognizing or just pointing out the really fundamental shift that's happened both in the labor market and in our immigration system in Canada. And this is where the numbers come in. What we have seen is a massive growth in temporary labor migration. It's important to remember that however much normalized that has become in our political and legal discourse, this is a tremendously new phenomenon. We have seen more than tripling in the size of the temporary labor migration program from the year 2000. So it's gone from just under 90,000 to the most recent figures are from 2012, 338,000 people. And that's a really hard number to wrap your head around. So I like to try and make that concrete by saying if all these workers with temporary status were grouped together in one location, they would be the 12th largest city in Canada. In the last few years, as I've been talking to people publicly about this issue, we have seen that that large migrant city move up the charts very quickly from the 17th largest city in Canada just 2 years ago to now the 12th largest city and growing. So that is a city that is bigger than Victoria and moving in really close on London, Ontario, of people without status in Canada, a third of them being low-wage migrant workers. And despite all the criticism that we have had of temporary labor migration over the last couple of years, the year-over-year increase continues to rocket up. So the year 2012 was an 11% increase over the year prior. Despite all the public outcry in 2012, we've seen another 5% increase over that in the year 2013. So it continues to grow. The other important thing is to note that migrant workers are the single largest stream of migration into Canada. They are larger than any of the other streams of permanent migration. So when we think about our immigration system and the regulation of that, what it is largely doing is creating a system of temporary status rather than permanent status. So if we look at, and then the numbers, the point, it was 2006 was the year that temporary migration began to outpace permanent migration in every year. And the figures from 2012, economic immigrants with permanent status, the total was 160,000. Migrant workers, temporary status, you can see far exceeds that, and the gap between the two of them is growing. The other thing I want to point out is that when you think about economic immigrants, the principal immigrants are the workers who are admitted into Canada because of their work skills, capacities, experience, and the rest of it is their spouses and dependents. So if you look at workers, the principal applicants, it's only 68,000. Almost 100,000 of them are their spouses and dependents. With the migrant workers, there are only workers, there are no spouses and dependents, right? So the gap is actually 68,000 workers with permanent status, 213,000 workers with temporary status, and they are, by law, separated from their families. Their families can only be here if you're low-wage migrant workers. You can only have your spouse here if they also independently have a temporary work permit. Your children are back home being looked after by someone else. And that, when I speak with migrant workers, that is always the most devastating part of their reality, is this extended separation from their children, from their spouses, and the devastation that that wreaks on their personal relationships, their extended personal relationships with their families and their communities, where you have entire communities distorted by very specific gendered patterns of migration, whether it's men from Mexico and the Caribbean coming up for agricultural work, or whether it's Filipino caregivers coming here to look after our children. You end up getting both a racialized and gendered distortion of the communities at home and of their lives when they are here. So that is the picture of the numbers who are coming in. What's also important to note is that over this period where we've seen the explosion of temporary labor migration is the expansion of the fields of work. Initially, Canada's temporary migration programs were targeted at very high-end, high-skill niche jobs where there was a very small pool of people with particular technical skills around the world who could be brought in, right? And that has now been expanded, particularly since 2002, to encompass every single occupation that is a legal occupation in Canada is open for temporary migration. And so what we see are more workers staying longer, doing a wider range of jobs. And part of the important recognition in seeing the range of work that people do is to push back against this mythology that we need to have temporary migrant workers because they are doing jobs that Canadians won't do, right? That the image that is always presented is of farm workers and of caregivers. But it is, in fact, the vast, like the wide array of jobs in the working class, in the middle class, doing caregiving, farm working, food processing, cleaning offices, cleaning hotels, restaurants, warehousing, telecommunications, sales, retail, fast food outlets, construction, mining. These are just some of the ones that have hit the news recently, but you know, I could list all the others as well, and we'd be here all day. It is the expansion, and that recognition of what we are doing is creating a working class of people without status, without democratic rights to affect the laws that structure their realities here, and without the power and the capacity to enforce the rights they have. It is an active process of undermining decent work, security of communities, and democracy. But what's important to know is that no worker is inherently vulnerable. Workers are made vulnerable by the laws that we choose to structure their relationships while they're in Canada. And that is the focus of my report, is that the workers that we see coming in on temporary labor migration programs are being brought here on terms that make them vulnerable to abuse and open to exploitation. The laws actively create conditions that lead to insecurity, and they fail to address known patterns of behavior that we know create insecurity. And that's why the report is called Made in Canada, because this is an entirely Made in Canada problem. We created the problem, we can fix it, but the first stage is to recognize that it's doing exactly what it was designed to do. A preliminary point, one of the difficulties, I guess, in addressing and trying to dismantle what we have in the temporary labor migration scheme is that it is legally quite a complex system. Part of it's an intersection between federal laws around immigration, so dealt with by the federal government, and provincial laws that regulate workers' employment and social rights when they're in the country. So you get a lot of jurisdictional football. Oh, it's hot, you know, hot potato. That's not our problem. You have to go talk to the feds. The feds will say, no, that's a provincial problem, or it's a municipal problem. So there's a lot of capacity for deniability of accountability around this. And so seeing how the different pieces of the system fit together is really important as a first step of trying to figure out how do you push back to dismantle it, and how, when politicians say that we've introduced some amendments that are going to fix it, is there any validity in those statements? Do they actually provide change, or are they window dressing? So one of the first things that we have with the immigration system is that it does very explicitly create a class-based set of rights. So OA and B level works, or it's the National Occupational Classifications that attributes or assigns skill levels to different kinds of jobs. OA and B are managerial, professional, and so-called skilled work. And C and D are considered the lower skilled jobs, where you need up to 2 years apprenticeship or on-the-job training, or D-level skills where it is strictly on-the-job training. And what you see in our immigration system is that OA and B level workers have multiple pathways into permanent status in Canada. But C and D level workers, with the exception of living caregivers, do not. They are caught in this cycle of permanent insecurity where they can only come into Canada with temporary status, and our laws actively require them to leave the country. So you get this cycling of a working class without status and limited rights. Sorry, that's a really horrible, fuzzy picture, but one of the things that I tried to do in the Made in Canada report is walk through the experience of labor migration for workers. And what we see is that at each stage of their experience of the laws fail to address the actual problems that they have, and they perpetuate known problems. So we know that migrant workers come to Canada under incredibly oppressive relationships of recruitment, where private recruiters are charging extortionate fees, are promising them jobs that don't actually exist, bringing them to Canada on terms where they have been misled about their opportunities for status. And yet we have laws that do not actively address that. They require workers to come forward to file complaints against their recruiters, as opposed to having any system of proactive licensing and registration. That's what we have in Ontario. We can talk about that later. The second level is that the federal immigration schemes that bring workers to Canada, particularly for low-wage workers, bring them in on tied permits that require them to work only for the work of the employer listed on the permit, at the job listed on the permit, in the location listed on the permit, for the particular time period. And a number of the programs also actively require that the worker live in the house of the employer or on the property of the employer. In practice, even those who do not have that formal legal requirement do. So you can see how coming into Canada on a tied work permit with tied housing already puts workers in an incredibly vulnerable position relative to enforcing their contract rights. They arrive in the country without information about what their legal rights are, how to enforce them, who's available here on the ground to help them enforce their rights. And then they're fed into a system where they are, the vast majority of them are not unionized. Farm workers in Ontario, live-in caregivers are by law denied the right to unionize. And many of the other workers who come in fact, work in non-unionized workplaces. So what they're living under is the employment standards system, which requires them to come forward and file complaints against their employers. But of course, we know that for workers with status, that system works very poorly, and that most people do not file complaints until they have left their oppressive job and found another job. For migrant workers, that is a complete fantasy. It cannot be activated. Because if they file a complaint or even voice a complaint with their employer, they are promptly terminated, they lose their job, they lose their housing. They are without status in Canada. It can take months to find another employer who will hire them and then go through the process of applying for a permit to authorize them an LMO or a work permit so that they can have their status re-regularized. And in that meantime, the workers are undocumented and subject to much more oppressive, exploitative conditions. So we know that without the access to effectively enforced rights, there's massive erosion of rights. A study that the Workers' Action Center did a couple of years ago showed that 20% of low-wage migrant workers in this sector
are being paid less than minimum wage. From the workers I've spoken to, it may well be much more than that. So 20% below minimum wage, fully a third of them not having overtime, not having those basic entitlements in the laws that that we have. When I've been speaking with living caregivers, for example, it is absolutely routine that they're paid flat fee, $1,000, $1,300 a month, regardless of how many hours they work. And many of them are working 60 hours or more every week at minimum wage, with no overtime. And on top of that, they're asked to do additional babysitting in the evenings and weekends because they're around anyway. They live in their employer's home. Employer's going out. Well, you're going to be here anyway. Look after the kids. No pay. So just on that basis, if you're getting $1,300 a month for working 60 hours a week, you should actually be getting an additional $1,300 a month in overtime that's not being paid. There's massive wage theft happening on the ground. Because it's a system that requires, there's no oversight, and it requires individual workers to come forward to enforce their rights. Their rights are segmented across a number of different tribunals, which means that it's not like there's one place that you can go to. Your rights are segmented between the civil courts, between the Employment Standards Tribunal, between the Human Rights Tribunal. It's a system that is inaccessible for workers generally, even more so for migrant workers. And the more that their stories are split up across those different tribunals, the more you lose the essence of what creates their vulnerability. Quickly through the last ones, everybody is on time-limited permits. We know that the law has introduced this new four-year-in, four-year-out rule, which means that workers must leave the country after 4 years of working here and cannot come in for another 4 years, even though their actual jobs continue. So we have temporary workers filling permanent jobs and cycling through. So a perpetual conveyor belt of workers on vulnerable status. And then the workers under the SOP who can come year after year after year, and many do for 25 years or more, without ever acquiring the right to apply for status, which means that at the end of the day, they get repatriated and move on. In the broader scheme of things, many of the workers who we see, their lives as migrant workers is a permanent thing. They've been working abroad with temporary status for many years. Before they get to Canada, it continues here. We perpetuate that cycle. But I just, sorry, two more minutes? Can I? What I want to say is that law is an active agent in creating this system, that the precarity that we see for workers is entirely predictable. It is the entirely predictable outcome of the system that we've created, and that all of these laws were active choices by government. None of this was accidental. It doesn't work. It's time to choose again. And so what we need is a vision of building security that sees people holistically, not just as inputs in the economic process, but as full human beings who contribute to our societies here and their communities at home. We need to help the workers who are caught in the system now. We need to do some serious unpacking of the myths around migrant labor, and we need to look to the opportunities we have to dismantle the system and build security throughout that labor migration cycle.